Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
I asked for that specifically from Elif just because I am I love John Williams' show. I love this song. I love everything about it. So when I was working on the Steve Cochran show, this would be the show I would listen to on the way home. And so I'd always hear the theme song, and I'm like, I love that. Ba-bom, bom, bom.
It's fun, right? Ba-bom,
bom, bom. So today you were going to play something else because that's John's theme song, and I'm Justin Coffin. I'm in for John. I said, no, you got to play that. You got to play that.
I love it. It's Prince.
Good, yeah, is it?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Hello, everybody. Justin Coffin in for King John today. He is in Europe. He is actually in London and Scotland for the week, and he probably has better weather than we do here. Similar. You know, rainy and foggy. So when he comes back and he complains about that, we'll tell him we had the same thing. Excited to be here today. And for you loyal John Williams listeners, he'll be back. And, of course, Elif and Lauren and Steve Bertrand are here as well. So you are in good hands. I'm just here to make sure that the trains run on time. 312-981-7200. Got a great show lined up today. We're going to talk. Mark Baser is going to come by, a regular to the John Williams show, King John. If John Williams is King John, that would make me what? That would make me like a Earl. Could I be an Earl? Or maybe like a Duke?
A Duke.
Duke.
I can see that. I can see you being a Duke.
Yeah, I'll go with Duke. Duke Justin.
I would go with the Council.
Council, yeah.
What would that make Steve, though?
Yeah. Steve's a jester.
the royal jester.
He could be a lord. He could be a sire.
Sire? What exactly does a sire do?
I don't know what a sire. I'm just trying to think of what. I don't know the extreme.
What about a squire?
Yeah,
a
squire, right? that's almost lowest.
Okay, I'll take that.
You'll take it, right?
And as long as we're talking about this, if he's the king, I have to be the princess.
Yeah, you're the princess. Okay. And then that would make, isn't Duke like an uncle? Isn't that the idea? Like you're a duke, an archduke of some sort. So that would be like Bertrand. So that would put me in the Earl category. So I'll go to Earl Justin.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, it's like
I don't either. That's why I'm looking at you like this.
There's some sort of Earl in the royalty hierarchy, but we'll stay with Duke. We got a big show lined up. Mark Baser, the regular here on the John Williams show, is coming by. He's going to talk about his hometown of Oak Park, and they're having a little bit of a clash, a little controversy over a mural at a middle school. You may have seen this last week, where there is a pretty WPA era mural that shows kids skating on a pond. It's a winter mural. The problem with the mural, the middle school says, is that the kids are all white that are in the actual photo. There's no diversity whatsoever. And Oak Park prides itself on being a diverse community. And so the question is it representative of Oak Park's history? Was there, you know, that's a moment in history and should stay there? Or is it not necessarily sensitive to the fact that it is an integrated, diverse community that is going to that school? So they're taking the mural down. Mark Baser lives there. We'll talk with him about that. He's got a show coming up at the Hideout as well. It's coming up here at 1:30. Coming up at 2 o'clock, we're going to talk a little bit about privacy, digital privacy. This is a big issue that I think a lot of people are starting to pay more attention to because of all of the devices that are considered smart devices in your home. State of Illinois is paying attention as well, as two bills are snaking through the House and Senate, and they look to be on the fast track to be approved because Governor Pritzker seems to be more in line with some of these privacy protection laws than his predecessor, Governor Rauner. But in this case, we saw this story that came out. I think Bloomberg did a big investigation that there are human beings that are listening through your device. I don't want to say the name because if you say the name, it turns it on in your house. That a thing? But essentially, they're listening to your commands that you're giving to your device, so that they can better customize the device to understand what you're saying. And there's a question that you, the question at the hand is, you did not know about that. You, when you bought that machine from Amazon or from other places, you did not know that there would be human beings being able to listen to you in your home. And these laws that are snaking through in Illinois are about making sure that you know that the consumer knows that that's not necessarily outlawing the practice, but know that the practice exists. And there is some pushback. You know, big companies don't want to have to go through those. They don't have to want to jump through those hoops. They don't want to have to, you know, tell you how they're gathering your data. And they do have a big lobby, and they've been able to influence state houses across the country. But we'll see in the state of Illinois in this month of May if digital privacy is going to get through. So we're going to talk about that coming up in the 2 o'clock hour. And also the NFL draft. Very interesting draft. I don't know if you're Chicago Bears fans out there. I'm a Chicago Bears fan. And we were told all the way around that this was going to be a draft that would be really about filling out the roster, giving some depth to this team that obviously won the NFC North and contended for a Super Bowl title this year. Didn't get there. Should have gotten there. Kicker. But we saw a big move where the Bears actually traded up to get a running back named David Montgomery, who, for all accounts, an Iowa State running back, is NFL ready and could be in the starting lineup for the Chicago Bears come opening day. We'll talk about what we know about David Montgomery coming up later in the 2 o'clock hour. So we got lots to do, as well as talk about Endgame, Avengers, which took in, unbelievably, $1.2
billion.
$1.2 billion internationally, and you know that that number is just going to get bigger because you know that Avengers Endgame is going to stay in theaters until September.
Right,
it's just going to be there forever. The movie...
Why wouldn't it?
Right.
At this rate...
I would wonder that, you know, when they put out the blockbusters in a couple of months, like the 4th of July, usually you'll have a blockbuster, if they will be competing to, if Endgame will still be competing with them, probably, for box office titles all the way into May, June, and July. But you know that's going to be in the theater, so it's going to make gobs and gobs of money. It was projected to make $800 to $900 million.
That's right.
Yeah, and now it's, and the totals came in projected higher at $1.2 billion. That's amazing. But I broke shattered all the records.
I remember when John and I were looking at the schedule of the movie theater schedules the other day, and he pointed out that every 15 minutes there was another showing at one of the locations.
The Avengers, the Marvel Universe, whoever, Disney owns Marvel, they got probably, I'm trying to think in my head, they probably got about $75 of my money. Between Disney and the ArcLight, because I went twice. I went Friday and Sunday. That's what an 11-year-old son will do to you. And I was trying to think about it. I'm like, yeah, they probably more than that. Probably, if you think about it, what is it, $15 a ticket?
Yeah.
Three of us. So you're already at 45, and you want to factor in some popcorn.
Popcorn, you know, drinks.
A nice large Diet Coke going for $6.50, whatever it might be. Yeah, by the end of it, I'm spending $100. My family spent $100 on Avengers Endgame this weekend.
That industry is just so lucrative. It's almost mind-blowing because you don't think about the popcorn and the drinks and everything if you're not a movie buff.
Right.
It's
you just
insane.
Wonder, you know, because there'll be... You wonder how... I would love to do a deep dive on how much... You know, what the relationship is between Hollywood and, say, AMC or ArcLight or some of the others, to see how the finances work out, the economics, because they must show those movies for free, because not unlike when a band goes on tour, a lot of times they don't have to pay to play, because they know that the venue knows they're going to get all the liquor sales, they're going to get the everything else, food, whatever else goes into it. So I wonder if it's the same way, if there's when you put Avengers Endgame into an ArcLight theater, ArcLight, you know, just gets the concession, and the rest of the ticket price goes straight to Endgame. I don't know how it works, but I'm sure somebody out there, 312-981-7200, knows. I actually have a math question I want to get to, and I'll do it right after the break, about what is the Endgame, and this David Wallach, who's a friend and a listener, he pointed out to me, he's like, what's the Endgame for the box office? when you have a movie that comes in at $1.2 billion, let's just say in North America, $350 million, what does Hollywood see as the end game? What's the highest it possibly can go? So we'll do a little math problem coming on the other side of this break to find out what is the end game for Hollywood when it comes to box offices. That's coming up here on the John Williams Show on WGN Radio. Stay with us. John Williams Show here. Justin Kaufman filling in for John, who is in London and Scotland this week. Earl John, Texter said, Courtchester, Justin. That should be it. But I feel like that's really low on the totem pole. That's like way down, right? You can't do that. Earl, Justin. 815 says, the theaters don't receive anything from new movies, only food purchases. Well, there you go. See? You're right, unless they're wrong. Here we go. So let's talk about Endgame. And I also want to talk about a little bit about the experience of seeing the movie in such a... Like I said, right before the break, I saw it twice with my son, my 11-year-old son. So I gave Marvel about and Arclight a good chunk of my money this weekend. $350 million in North America, $1.2 billion worldwide. It was projected to get $850 million to $900 million, so it beat the projections. But it accounted for at least 4 out of every 5 tickets sold in the U.S. over the weekend. When I was at Arclight, when you looked up at the board, I took a picture because it was showing Endgame, like John said, every 15 minutes. And there was only one, I think there was one film that was there that was for a film festival, and the other was Captain Marvel. But there were 20 screenings, or whatever it might be. There might be less, but whatever, Arclight in Chicago and Halstead. They all were screening Avengers Endgame. And when I came the second night, this was the second day, yesterday, the lobby was completely packed. There were a ton of people in there. And I went up to the, when I finally got up there and I gave them, the tickets to get in, they said, you got to wait. It was 1:15. The movie started at 1:30. And they're like, we're still cleaning. It's not ready yet. When have you been to a theater? And I asked this of the crew. When have you been to a theater when it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes before the film and they won't let you in because they're cleaning the theater?
Never.
Right?
Maybe one time ever.
And that's because maybe someone spilled a ton of stuff. But this was just, they had dropped, I mean, because they had squeezed in as many showings as possible of Avengers Endgame, because they want to make their money, they were, one audience was coming out while another one was coming in. This was a ballet of theater goers that was happening at Arclight, and they would get behind. And so we got in there probably when they finally opened the doors, if you will. You had 5 minutes, essentially, before the movie started. And everyone just kind of ran to their seats. It was like a roller coaster.
That reminds me of airplanes. A lot of times the crew is in cleaning up the seats as you're getting off, because they don't give themselves a lot of time.
Lauren, it was a lot like we were making jokes in the line, because everyone who had the 1:30 ticket, they kept hovering. Just like when you're about to board a plane.
Impatient.
Yeah. We were all like, is it my turn? Can I get back up there? And then when they said, okay, the 1:30 is ready, this is assigned seating. There's no overhead bins. There's no luggage that needs to be worried about it. But everyone like just jumped in. Like it was like a mad dash for to get to the ticket taker.
And that is like when you, what's the word? It's when you get off a plane and everybody's trying to get off. And it's like, you're going to get off at the end of the day. So... Why are you rushing?
And there's some etiquette to that, right? There's etiquette to how you deboard a plane.
That's
board a plane, right?
Right, row by row.
Right, everybody knows. And the one person always tries to jump ahead. You're like, you will be shamed in my head forever. But I have to say, there's no etiquette to entering a movie theater. Because it's just that you never have to wait to go into a movie. I mean, they want you there early because you'll eat all your popcorn and you go back to the concessions. This was the first time I've seen lines of, I mean, because I've been to many opening nights, whether it be a Star Wars or a Marvel movie or whatever it might be, but this was entirely different, mostly because Arclight was doing everything they possibly could to squeeze out as many tickets as they could for Avengers Endgame. And the question I have, and this is the math question I want to get to before we get to the news. So, okay, so it's set, or this is David Wallach wrote this. I'll just read what he wrote me this morning. Endgame set the record at $1.2 billion for the weekend box office. What is the max that can be earned in a weekend? At some point, there has to be a max, right? If every theater in the U.S. or the world plays the movie 24/7 for the weekend in every theater and they sell out every seat, what is that number? There has to be an end game to earnings, doesn't there? That's what he wrote to me. I thought it was very interesting, so I started to think about it. Who's the math genius on our squad? Is it?
Definitely John, not me.
John?
Steve Bertrand, here. You don't do math?
I do not do math.
All right, I'll throw it out to our listeners because I know our listeners do. 312-981-7200. So I looked it up. I just looked up some raw numbers. We can figure this out. We'll just do North America, okay? There's 40,000 screens, give or take. This was a number that I picked up from 2014, 2015. It could be more, it could be less. But let's just round up to 40,000 screens in the United States, okay? 40,000 screens. Then you look up how many seats. They said 200 to 300 seats. Let's go on the high end there. So 300 seats in 40,000 screens. We got that? Let's round up on how much a ticket costs. $15? Is that good for everybody at this point? It's a ridiculous amount of money to spend for a movie, but
sure.
That's what it but is sounds in 2019, about right? right? You can go high end or low end, but if you really say, you know, if you want to find a median, it's $15. The movie's 3 hours, so let's just say that instead of, you know, 24 hours in a day, so you're 8 and 3, 24. Let's say 7 showings in a day, so we'll give the 3 hours for cleaning. Okay? So you got that? So 7 showings of the three-hour movie to 300 people on 40,000 screens at $15 a ticket. 4 days in a weekend. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So whoever's out, 312-981-7200, we'll give you a prize. Ellis, can we ask Sarah for a prize, a pizza or something, if they get this right? But what is the max number that a movie in Hollywood could make if using those numbers? 40,000 screens, 300 people per screen, $15 per ticket. 7 showings on those screens in 4-day weekend. You got it, Steve Bertrand?
A gazillion.
It's a lot of numbers. I'm sure mathematicians who are listening are like, that's not how you would set it up. But
okay, I have one, though.
All right, what do you got?
On my calculator, it says 1.26E9.
Okay.
I forgot what the E means.
What is the E?
I haven't seen that since
eternity?
High school.
It could be an eternity
or
thing?
College.
Endgame?
I think it means eternal. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know.
It's I don't know either, but
time.
So 1.2. So, but that's interesting. So, it would have to be more like they got. So the number was 3 out of every 4 tickets sold this weekend went to Marvel Avengers, to the Avengers Endgame. So the idea being, what would essentially the problem would be? What's 4 out of 4? Meaning every ticket that was sold. So we'll get that answer coming up here before maybe we'll get Mark Baser, who's up next. Maybe he's a math guy.
Well, at least it would be fun to listen to him struggle over it.
Exactly. John Williams Show. Thanks, Steve Bertrand. Justin Kaufman in for John Williams. Mark Baser's here. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Good to see you, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
You're not doing the interview show this Friday. You're doing a different show. You decided that the interview show is played out.
No. This is the interview show presents.
Oh, really? Never mind. You decided you needed bigger.
Expanding the brand.
You're a brand guy.
Yeah.
That's great.
Which has attracted 3 people, 3 ticket sales off of that.
You're more of a door guy. You didn't need pre-sale. You're not a pre-sale guy.
You know, we switched about a few years ago from all door to pre-sale.
Yeah.
And it went from being the most nerve-wracking thing, because you don't know who's going to show up at the door, to like the second most nerve-wracking thing. Because now you have a month to worry about. Yeah, right. I'm constantly calling the guy and be like, how many tickets do we sell? Yeah. Can you post it on Facebook?
Do you have a non-mind-bending thing or non-stress-building thing? It seems like everything would build stress for you.
Somebody today gave me some CBD oil that I could spread all over my neck, but they told me that it would make me smell really bad. So that is also nerve-wracking. So no, to answer your question, Steve.
All right. Well, Mark Baser, we're going to talk about your show, and we'll also talk about your hometown of Oak Park in just a second. I want to get to the callers who have the answers for my mind-bending Avengers Endgame question about what is the endgame for the box office? How much can you make in the United States on one weekend if you sold every ticket and showed in every... What is the endgame for Hollywood? Let's go to Chris. Chris, what do you think? Chris, what do you got?
Well, I just wanted to say, if you turn the calculator sideways, that makes the E go away, so that would have made it a little easier to read the number.
Okay,
but the hugely inaccurate number I got from your calculation was about 5,040,000,000.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's what I've seen in my quick summer when I tried to do it. It was somewhere around 5.4.
But if the tickets were like, if 3 out of 4 tickets were sold that were for Endgame, then couldn't you just divide the number that Endgame made by 3, then multiply it by 4?
Well, Chris, it was great talking to you. Thanks for joining.
What about people who buy a ticket for another movie
and then
walk into
Endgame?
Yeah, think about that. Or exactly. Stay for the next showing. Just spend the whole day watching it over and over again,
there's
crying during the last hour.
There's a lot we didn't factor in. Thanks, Chris. Stay on the line.
Yeah. Okay.
So true. It is so true. But that's the number that seemed. There's also a lot of texters who got to the same number. The number was, it's all unscientific because there's a lot of estimating, and then I just chose the factors of the math equation. There's some mathematicians who text in who said that's not the way you would do it, and I'm like, I know. But in this case, we're on a radio show,
it's AM radio, not University of Chicago.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I do.
What about the money from people who film it in the back, and then
you're not factoring in black market Canal Street money,
yeah,
right, all that kind of stuff,
along with a pair of socks.
You get a pair of socks.
We'll slip a copy of Endgame into that pair of socks.
A VHS copy of Endgame.
I miss those socks.
Yeah. Mark, so you have the show coming up. Let's talk about that first, and we'll talk about Oak Park.
But sure.
You've decided to do something different. So this is called I'm Ambivalent Towards the 90s.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, so my friend and I, a musician friend who lives in New York, who I met in the 90s in college here, decided that we wanted to do a show together, and we thought, well, this is where our friendship was birthed in the 90s. It's also where, here's what happened. A few years ago, I was doing my show. And I was interviewing this woman she was a teenager at the time. Her name is Tavi Gevinson. Yeah, right. She's a blogger. She was a fashion person. Now she acts on Broadway. She was already a big deal at age 14.
Right.
And she said to me that she liked to go back and study fashion from different decades in history. And I said, oh, that's interesting. What decades? And I think, you know, the punchline, like she said, the 90s. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? That's yesterday. And then it's not. It's history. 90s are a long time ago. And I think for a lot of us who kind of came of age during the 90s and also used to think of it as this kind of glorious, nothing was wrong era, I don't know. It's kind of interesting now to kind of contend with that. Was it a totally peaceful, nothing was wrong? Were we ignoring things? Was our, I'm in Generation X. I don't really play up to cliches that much, but was our, were we not caring about stuff in the way we should have cared about stuff? So the show is a bunch of music. It's David playing different songs from the 90s. And then a bunch of people reading essays, a very hideout show, about themes in the 90s. So one person, Mick Dumpke from the ProPublica, is doing something on politics in the 90s. Claire Zulke, who does a show at the Hideout, is doing something on the internet, because it was really the last decade before our lives weren't controlled by the internet, but it was there. Monica Ang from another radio station is doing something on food in the 90s. She covered food in the 90s at a time when that was still, like, it was Charlie Trotter's world.
Yeah, right.
You know, but there were plenty of other things going on. So different themes.
Monica did the story, and it might have been 2000s, but she did the story on nacho cheese sauce in the schools, because they were pouring nacho cheese sauce on everything.
Yeah.
And acting like there was nutritional value.
Even on the assignments.
That was a big thing. It could have been the 90s and CPS as well. But yeah, it is interesting for you personally. You come of age. I mean, we met in the 90s.
Yeah, we're the same age. What are we talking about?
But what does the 90s mean? Are you nostalgic about that time?
Well, I'm trying not to be. I'm trying not to be in the show. I don't know that I am. I'm regretful of what I wasted in the 90s, I think. I've slept a lot during the 90s. And I see people now who are doing a lot of things when they're in their 20s. And I'm like, God, maybe those four-hour naps on Saturday weren't the secret to success. I am nostalgic, though. I am. And I'm trying not to be unabashedly so. And I'm also trying to kind of look at where I shouldn't have been nostalgic. For example, it was a time when a lot of I formed who a lot of my heroes were. And some of those heroes have not worked out so well For example, I discovered Woody Allen in the 90s. I thought he was great. I wanted to write like Woody Allen. And now Woody Allen, I can't separate my enjoyment of the work. I do. Mm-hmm. But he's so highly problematic. Yeah. So I was kind of wrestling with those kind of themes as well. I'm going to do none of that. I'm just going to make an intro and then go let drink at the bar while other people...
That's really what this is.
Yeah,
this is
let it's a way to take the month off, right, to tell you the truth.
Well, it is... I wonder about it, too, because I think about, like, for instance, both of us have done comedy. And we did. I did a lot of comedy at Second City and around Chicago in the 90s. And the tone was different.
Yeah.
And we see this from comics who no longer want to go to college campuses because they feel like it got overly
PC. Chris Rock
has
said that. Seinfeld, whose birthday is today, said that.
But the truth was, the late 90s, there was a very cynical, cynicism was running through our blood in the way that it almost felt like that was the kind of comedy that everybody was gravitating towards.
That's right. And I guess the question I'd ask of them is on the one hand, I totally empathize and side with them. On the other hand, I think we're just maybe being lazy. So Gina, my wife, who, you know, she's also wrote a piece for it. And she made an interesting point also about Chicago in the 90s, which is, I don't know, when I moved here in the 90s, it was still kind of that last vestige of that old Chicago that, like, I mean, I still love Chicago hot dogs, but back then it was like Chicago hot dogs, Blues Brothers, Walter Payton. Like, that was still like the guy in the L collecting
right,
your money.
Right, right.
Like, and the 90s were kind of that period where the city said, we want to be a global city. We don't want to be that kind of great but cliche version of our past,
right,
which I also think hopefully people will. And
there's something about it, too, that's a great observation. And it also was this moment where, and I know Mick will point to it, but this was the Daley administration, the mayor, Richard M. Daley, time,
yeah,
where it was just that there was not a, as we know it now, like factions. There was straight up, you voted for Mayor Daley or nothing.
Yeah, the machine was still, nobody was talking about the last days of the machine.
And they held on tight to what they wanted Chicago to be.
There was a convention then, too, right?
1996.
So we were revisiting. It was kind of a weird, mm-hmm, like, Chicago's not going to do what we did in 68 kind of thing,
right,
too, which was also...
So you have the politics, which is, and a huge scandal, people forget. Silver Shovel was in the 90s where aldermen were being bribed to dump industrial waste in different abandoned lots in some Chicago neighborhoods, and aldermen went down for that. There were 5-10 aldermen that got arrested for that stuff. And then I think about the media here in Chicago was very strong. You had the newspapers were huge at that time. You had Oprah Winfrey was on the West Side and what is now the West Loop. It was
all of daytime talk, right?
Yeah, right.
Donahue, who's the Jenny Jones.
Jenny Jones.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
People used to stay at the hotel right on, what street was that? Right downtown here. For the Jenny Jones show, and there was a diner there, and you'd go in there, and you didn't have to go watch the Jenny Jones show because they'd be performing basically at lunch.
It was the Cambridge Inn, wasn't it? Was that what it was called?
Yeah.
The diner?
Yeah, it was awesome. It was like, there's not the gas for the show.
Hey, you want to see
acting
Jenny
totally
Jones?
Crazy.
Let's just go to the lot. Let's go to the diner.
Yeah, get a grilled cheese.
Yeah, it was a good diner.
Yeah, it was good.
Mark Baser's here. His show, I'm Ambivalent Towards the 90s, is going to be at the Hideout this Friday night. We come back. Let's talk about Oak Park.
Sure.
There's a little bit of controversy brewing at a middle school. It's usually
it's only at the middle schools.
Only at the middle schools. It's John Williams. I'm Justin Kaufman. In for John. We'll be right back. Texter says, 815 says, buying for another movie and sneaking into another one doesn't work anymore because now it's reserved seating. It's a good point. They're messing with your flow.
That's true. Some theaters, not all theaters.
You search out the ones that are still free-for-alls.
The one where I live is a free-for-all.
I don't want to get off on a tangent, but the one thing I will say is when you have such an anticipated movie experience like Avengers Endgame, for someone who has watched all the movies and has an 11-year-old son, it's anticipated. There's a lot of anticipation. Every moment of this 3-hour movie matters. So the Jamoke who shows up 10 minutes late with his iPhone light on trying to find his seat and then unsuccessfully asking someone to move because he thinks it's in their seat, but it's not, but it's one back. Unacceptable.
Why don't we treat it like the opera?
Right.
You can only come in at a new scene.
I don't mind if it's Fast and Furious or some other garbage movie, but the Avengers Endgame, we're waiting on this. We've been waiting for a year on this.
My 13-year-old saw it and then told me what happened.
You're like, thanks.
Thanks, Dad.
The other thing that happened, this is blow your mind. I'm in the theater. It's Friday. So everyone's all excited. Everyone's ramped up. This is the first showing, like 4:40, 5 o'clock or something like this. Everyone's like, you know, this is it. This is it. Guy comes in. He does his little spiel now. You got the guy at Arclight who tells you all the cool things about who's in it and don't go out that exit and blah, blah, blah. Half hour, 45 minutes in, woman walks down the stairs. The whole theater is watching her look at the emergency exit, walk towards the emergency exit, and open the emergency exit door.
Ugh.
And it goes, pew, 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 right in the middle of Avengers Endgame.
And what happened?
They quick, luckily, because I think they're now savvy to it,
yeah.
The bell's 5 seconds. And then it's over.
The other thing that's unfortunate about it is, I don't know about you, but like you start thinking about bad stuff that happens, that's happened in theaters people pull that kind of stuff.
Well, we all watched her. We knew.
She was not dangerous.
She was just like, she had a thing of popcorn. She's like, where do I put it? Where do I go to the bathroom?
Yeah, if you're going to do something dangerous, you don't have the popcorn in your hand.
But it was just like, I mean, you're trying everything you possibly can to not be taken out of the moment in this moment, because it was such a highly anticipated film. And so littlest things like coming in late, looking at your cell phone, going through the emergency exit, which you could let go in any other situation, it stuck with me.
I don't want to go out to things now, because things I really am looking forward to sometimes. I know Steve Bertrand will think I'm becoming nerve-wracked again. But I feel like if somebody throws me off, then I'm out. They've ruined it for me.
They ruined the whole narrative.
Yeah, they've ruined it.
The memory will be
shaded. I'm sorry the movie was so bad for you.
I was one more thing about movies. I went on a date night with my wife, and I was like, okay, this is something. I haven't gone to a movie at 9 o'clock at night in a long time. I have an 11-year-old son, so most of the movies are going to be earlier, right? So you're playing with a more family-friendly. Sure. This was one of those movies where you can recline the seat, you know, maybe get a beer.
One of the movies.
Yeah, not the movies, the theaters, right? And this guy, the people next to me, they show up. They bring food in from outside. But it's not like the kind like you and I would sneak like some raisinettes in from the Walgreens.
It's like a steak.
It was a takeout with the white plastic bag with the styrofoam things stacked.
Yeah.
You know, like that you would see a delivery guy bringing like five over, like, and it was Chinese food. and I couldn't believe it. I'm like, I really was like, I was the first time ever in my life. I'm like, what is the rule here? Is there rules in this place? I'd like to see the rules for AMC. I'd like to see the rules.
Were they like passing it back and forth to each other?
It was like six people, and they brought dinner.
Was somebody coming around to refill their water every few seconds?
That's what I was hoping. I was like,
all this stuff happened to you this weekend?
No, this was a pass.
Oh, okay.
How many films did you see?
I saw 6 hours of my life was taken by the theaters. But I'm just saying, like that experience. Now I'll never go to a theater. I'll never go to a date night after 9 o'clock at night.
Justin, do what I do. I ask myself, will I have a better time if I go out or just stay home? And look at the wall. And, you know, half the time it's just a wall.
Okay, so let's talk about Oak Park. This is something that was in the news this week about a mural at a middle school.
Yeah.
A mural that has been, it's a WPA project that was put up. It's a winter mural that shows the kids skating and having fun. But the problem is that the kids in this are all white.
So, yeah, it's actually at my son's school. And it's interesting. From a personal standpoint, my son was learning about the 30s and the Great Depression. And I said to him, hey, you know that big, I don't know why they call it a mural. It's really a big painting. Do you know that big painting / mural that hangs in your cafeteria? He says, yeah. And I said, it was paid for through a WPA project. So back in the 30s, when they were trying to get the government primed or the economy primed, the government paid for not just roads and infrastructure and things like that, but they also paid artists to make stuff. And he went to his teacher, and he told his teacher, and his teacher was like, yeah, we were going to talk about that. And it was a nice kind of learning experience. I've also, every time I'm in that cafeteria, whether it's for, like, if there's a community event or something like that, we'll be there. I always take a few moments to look at it and think, God, that's a pretty cool thing that they have. It's a real nice piece of history.
It's history, right.
And then we got at the end of the week, we got an email from the principal saying that there was had been a long simmering argument over it, or discussion, not even an argument, and that there was a group of students at the school, a social justice group, that felt that the mural did not, you know, it's all, like you said, it's all white. It's a very idyllic winter scene. exactly what you said.
Skating around the pond.
Skating and sledding. And there's nothing offensive about the picture other than what's not in the picture, which is that Oak Park, the school, is the number something like 52% white at the school. So that's not, I mean, it's the majority, but it's not a huge majority by any means. And that all the kids are white, and it reflects, it was made, I think, in 1937. It very much reflects the times that it was in. It wasn't always, I mean, the school doesn't date back to that far either. So it wasn't always in the school. It was somewhere else. But they decided, the school, with this committee of students, and I think either a parent or a teacher, decided that they were going to take it down, which they have. And that has caused not a huge controversy. I mean, I don't think it's on par with the Mueller report, but like, it's something that people are. And at first, my opinion was, this is ridiculous.
Right.
Come on. There's nothing offensive about it. But I talked to my son, and my son was like, well, wait a minute. I know, you know, you like the painting, Mark, but you like other paintings, too. And the kids, he said, he felt presented a pretty interesting, and he thought, he believed it, defense of taking down the picture.
It's interesting, and obviously we can get in bigger questions about, you know, what to do with historical piece, because this is really the same, in the same family of the arguments about the Confederate statues and things like that.
Yeah, I would say it's different, but it is in the same family.
Right.
It's a, you know, the Confederate ones stand for something that is, you know, much different than what a scene of snow.
An Oak Park historian came out and said this is similar to book burning, or is that what we're doing? That was one of the quotes that came out of this article.
Yeah, Eric Zorn had an article about it.
Yeah, and I just wonder, you know, at the end of the day, it's very interesting, and I think it was Lee Bay, it was someone on Facebook who was talking about, you know, you could just do a little research, and there were African Americans who lived in Oak Park at the time, and the question and the issue with this mural is, was there erasure? Was there this idea that we're not going to recognize this community because that's not who we think Oak Park is, and therefore eliminating them from history?
My guess is no. My guess is, and first of all, I think I read another stat that it was very, very small. My guess is that it was just a woman painting what she thought of. I mean, think about the Peanuts. Like, they introduced a black character eventually, but it wasn't like George Shultz was thinking, white kids. He just didn't think about it.
Right.
But my son's point, which was a point that others were making that he bought into, was, you know, a kid was saying, I come into school, none of my teachers are black. I don't see any black adult role models throughout my day. I mean, there are black teachers at the school, but not in this kid's team. And then I come to the cafeteria and I look up at this scene of kids who, whether directly or not, in some way represent the student body, and I don't see myself. Yeah. Now, the suggestion that others have made, which I think I buy more, is that keep that up. It's an important piece of history, and then have another
painting
elsewhere in the building or elsewhere in the room that says, look where we've come. Yeah. Look where we're at now.
Nice compromise. Mark Baser, you can see him in his show, I'm Ambivalent Towards the 90s, which is at the Hideout at what time on Friday?
It's at 6:30.
6:30. Of course, you can check out the interview show, which is also at the Hideout, and on WTTV.
And we have a podcast, too.
We have a podcast as well. That's
so
right.
If I would love if people checked it out. It's the interview show with Mark Baser, and they can subscribe and hopefully like it.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Justin Kaufman in for John Williams. Thank you, Ella, for keeping the theme song. I love that. Thinking big thoughts. You don't have to. As I mentioned at the top of the show, when I worked with Steve Cochran on the morning show, my day would end right around 1 o'clock, 1:30, and I would drive home, and John Williams in this program was always in lock on my car stereo. 312-981-7200. So I thank you, Ella, for playing that song, which I'm always like, oh, I love that. But boom, boom, boom.
You're welcome.
It's the little things, right? Well, let's talk Springfield. This is a big week starting off. I saw that most of the newspapers in the Springfield coverage pointed out that there are only 5 weeks left of the spring session, as Steve Bertrand said so eloquently at the beginning. That means 4.5 weeks till anything gets done. That's how Springfield works. The last week of the last half of the last week is usually when everything starts to be rapid fire. But for the governor in his first term, in his first spring session, there's a lot riding, whether it be a graduated income tax and opening up the state constitution. You also have revenue streams such as recreational marijuana, which is on the table, casinos. There's a lot of activity in Springfield about the agenda that the new governor is putting forth. One of the issues that rarely gets talked about, but it has been a contentious one in Illinois, is about data privacy. And this is an interesting area of really understanding how big companies and digital companies are using your data. We've seen this over and over and over. There's actually a piece this week about how Amazon is actually having human beings listening to you in your house as you interact with its device. I like to say the name because then it turns on, everyone gets mad because it's a radio. but the idea that it's interact, so humans are listening to you too. Their argument is it better customizes for you for the machine to understand what your commands are. But I believe that 100% of us did not know that was happening, and that really is at the heart of what some of these bills snaking through the state house and in Springfield are about. In studio, Matt Erickson. He's the director of the Digital Privacy Alliance. We're going to talk about Matt. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
All right, so let's get into this. There are two bills, right? There are
yes.
two, but this is really about making companies tell you that mm-hmm. they're listening.
right. And that's really all these bills are about, making sure that you know what's happening with your data as it's being collected and where it's being sent to. For example, the Amazon listening widget.
Thank you.
the Amazon widget that you referenced, that's great that there's people that are actually trying to make the voice recognition better, because we're building this whole Star Trek future, right? But they got to tell you that there's going to be people listening.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a deal breaker for me, to think that there are actually people listening to an open device in your home.
I mean, you could be working as a law enforcement officer working on a case. You could be working on a startup that maybe competes with Amazon and talking about your business plans. You could be just having private conversations in the privacy of your own home that you don't expect anybody else to hear. Maybe you'd be acting a little differently if you knew that there would be an actual human listening to what you're talking about.
This seems like a no-brainer, in the sense that I think that we all are used to terms and services, meaning mm-hmm. we're going to click that box regardless when Apple or Amazon or Google tells us they want something. We're like, I don't care. So at least that was a part of, you know, we were on the hook. We were just lazy about it.
Right.
But in these cases, there's not even a terms and services. This is just something that a whole industry is being built off the secretive nature of collecting data without you knowing.
Right. And that's what we call the surveillance economy. So the idea is to better market actual things to people. We watch where people are going, what they're doing, who they're interacting with, what they're saying online, how they're saying things online, to better tailor ads for people. So basically selling their attention, selling them for money. And, you know, that does enable a lot of free services.
And also makes it more customizable. People would recognize
yeah.
quickly that their lives might be easier because certain companies recognize what they want and they cut through the garbage to get there.
Sure. Like I always say, if somebody knows where I go to vacation a bunch, and if in a completely upstanding way I start seeing reduced airfares to my favorite vacation spot,
absolutely,
that's great.
Right.
But the thing is, I need to know as a consumer that my data is being used in such a manner, that my data is not being leaked, that my data is kept under safe control. And that's a big problem.
So
today.
Why up to this point? And I guess it seems like a no-brainer, because I think everybody who's listening right now would say, yeah, I'm willing to give you my data, but I want to know that you're collecting it. So what up to this point, why has it been so hard for governments, for state houses across the country, not just in Illinois, to enact these kind of laws?
Well, there's been a lot of opposition from out-of-state big tech interests. So the Amazons, the Googles, Verizon, Comcast, large, huge corporations that have a vested interest in the surveillance economy, because people do act differently when they know they're being watched.
Interesting. So that's really what this is about, that they know they're getting a different kind of interaction because you know you're not, you don't know you're being watched.
Right. And that's... And the thing is, if people knew that they were being watched, some of it can be a little creepy. For example, with advertisements, I can hyper-target an advertisement to that would trigger just on you if I know you well enough. And when I see where that ad fires, now I have a real-time tracking of where you are just by about $1,000. I mean, there's implications there for anything from law enforcement, domestic violence. Like, it's just really creepy.
So for Illinois, this is not the first time this kind of thing has come up. We saw in the last administration vetoes on mm-hmm. some of these data privacy ideas. I think it was a little different on geolocating.
Right.
But Governor Rauner and the Republicans, they didn't support this idea of making it transparent. Why? Because it seems like this would be something that would be right up their alley to say we want to protect our constituents to make sure that they're not being taken advantage of.
Well, that's... It's pretty interesting that you talk about Rauner and the Republicans. I want to make a bit of a distinction here. The bills that we're supporting do have bipartisan support. Most Illinois...
You would think they would,
yeah,
right.
Most Illinois Republicans represent people who just want to be left alone.
Sure. That's my point, I think, is that I'm not understanding why there was a veto. Was it the way it was
corporate
written?
Interest. It was really corporate interest.
So you're talking about the Googles and the world coming down and using lobbying money to say this is not in our interest, please help us.
Yeah, they're... You know, there's increasing privacy restrictions going on in California. Now these companies want to make sure that it doesn't spread to the rest of the country.
Interesting. Matt Erickson's my guest. He is a director at the Digital Privacy Alliance. We'll talk more coming up here. We'll take a quick break. Also, if you want to join the conversation, 312-981-7200. Let's take that break. We'll come back and continue. Stay with us. Lisa's on the line. Lisa, you got a question for my guest, Matt Erickson. What is it?
Yes, hi. I've heard a little bit about this surveillance piece before, but I'm curious. Like these devices you're talking about, the Amazons and whatnot, for surveillance, is it when you, are people listening on the other line, when you're just activating the device, or are you saying just in general, if you have that in your home, there's people listening in on your conversation?
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Do you know the answer, Matt?
Generally, that's stuff that's been recorded and kept on their servers and picked up for quality control purposes, basically.
Yeah. So they're essentially listening at all times. Joe, you might have the answer for Lisa. You have a situation that's happening with your digital devices.
I got a gift from our company. They work for a large company who gives us gifts every now and then. And they gave us all the Echo. This was about a year and a half ago. And we would be sitting, my wife and I would be sitting in the house. I mean, we could be reading or doing whatever. And it would spark up and say, I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
It just would say that? Yeah.
And it would do this quite often. And we weren't watching television, really, or doing anything else. But we could be in another room talking, and it would spark up and say that to us. So I disconnected it and threw it in the closet. That's where it's been sitting for the better part of a year.
Good to know. Thanks, Joe. That's something I guess you'd have to think about. Let's go to Sue. Sue's on the line. Sue, you say this is a good point, that there are different countries that deal with data in different ways.
Right, and thank you for taking my call. This was discussed not too long ago on GN, and the expert they had on was discussing laws, especially in Western Europe, how that is handled, and that I know it's a much larger issue, but I just wondered if the guest maybe could elaborate on that a bit.
Thank you, Sue. We'll find out. We'll ask. Matt, I mean, there's got to be different ways that different countries and municipalities are dealing with data collection, or at least the idea that surveillance needs to be transparent.
Yeah, and that's... the European Union has the GDPR, which is a extremely thick set of regulations on people's data privacy, including pretty interesting concepts like the right to be forgotten, where you can say, hey, I just... make me disappear off of the service. Then including data controllers and consent decrees. And it's a pretty hefty thing. And I think one of its downsides is, as I'm sitting here talking about problems that the tech industry is bringing to us, the GDPR really wasn't... the tech industry just kind of, I think, ignored it and hoped it would go away. And so you wound up with a really... interesting set of framework that I think is a bit overcomplicated to get everything done that we really want done at the base level.
You know, Matt, it is, as we look to this in the next 5 weeks, are you confident that the state of Illinois, I mean, because it's Democrat control, and the governor has been open to, if it came to his desk, he would be willing to sign it, and it's already come out of the Senate, so it's really all eyes on the House. Are you concerned that that prevailing corporate interests will sort of step in here and make this a tougher sell for Democrat lawmakers?
Well, that's like I said earlier, I don't think it's necessarily a partisan issue. We have bipartisan support here, and it is really how much money are large out-of-state corporate interests going to be throwing around in Springfield, and how much lawmakers are going to be paying attention to their constituents or the checkbook writers.
Okay, so let's. I've talked about this on Extension 720. I've talked about other things, just about how younger generations are handling or looking at what their data is worth. And I see this I had a guy on who was talking about gaming, right? He was talking about esports and others, and the conversation delved into this place where younger generations are more understanding of what they have, what their data is worth. And they use it, meaning they will give away their data for extra coins. They will for more playing opportunities inside the game. But there seems to be this relationship that's happening in the startup culture and in the gaming culture, where they recognize there may be more worth to personal data. Do you think you see a future in which we're all aware that our data is worth something and that we can negotiate with it?
Yeah, I mean, our data is worth something. That's the reason why the whole surveillance economy exists. And so I think it'd be great if I knew how much my personal information, my data stream, is getting me and what's being done with it. I mean, we're not saying stop this whole economy.
Right, right.
We're saying, you know, let people make informed, consensual choices based on truthful information.
And that really is a backbone of why I would imagine companies, digital companies, big tech companies want to keep this secret. Because then they're going to have to negotiate to pay for it.
Right.
That comes down to the end of the day,
yeah.
Right? Okay, so my last question for you, and this is a question I think that everybody listening is, you know, it sort of falls between conspiracy theory and actual, you know, theory. But I have said this many times where I'll be sitting in my living room, I'll be talking about something with my wife, and we're talking, and the next thing you know, whether it be on our Wi-Fi, whether it be on our Facebook or Twitter or on our Comcast or whatever, an ad comes up for what we were just talking about. Now, the conspiracy theory is they're listening to us. They know what we're talking about, and they're able to serve whatever ad it is in the moment, and we are being surveilled at all times. Is that accurate from you at the Digital Privacy Alliance? Do you feel like that's something that is happening, or is that just the consumer having conspiracy theory moments?
You know, I keep hearing this question a lot. It phrased exactly the same way from a lot of different people with a lot of just their own personal experiences driving the question, and you know, we've been trying to piece through this, but, you know, if I were Amazon, I would definitely be putting a little ring around my address to make sure that I wasn't actually testing it. Yeah, right, but right. The thing is, with the Keep Internet Devices Safe Act, currently in Springfield, we'll be able to know if this is going on. If they can comply with the terms of service, the requirements in the bill, the terms of service will tell us if they're doing this or not, and then it'll be bright as day.
Very interesting, and we'll be paying attention to what happens in the next 5 weeks in Springfield. Matt Erickson is the director of the Digital Privacy Alliance. Matt, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve Bertrand. Justin Kaufman in for John Williams today. Be back on Wednesday as well. 312-981-7200. Well, you may have watched the NFL draft. I watched a lot of it during this incredible snowstorm.
It's like watching someone plant a garden, isn't it? I mean, it may or may not bear fruit years from now.
Well, they do such an interesting...
With
glitz. It's amazing how many stories they have and how much is already queued up, and the humanizing stories where they go into their house and they watch. I mean, there's something to be said if you really dig into the NFL draft broadcast. They really do make it entertaining. I don't know if any of these players would be worthwhile scoring touchdowns on Sundays in the NFL, but you're like, this person grew up without, you know.
See, to me, it is such a manufactured sales event now. you know, it goes over a period of days. It's prime time. It's it's all about keeping the NFL in the cash register all year round.
Yeah, I could see that.
Right? I mean, how many of these players who were drafted this weekend will never play an NFL game?
Well, Kev Powell, I wonder. I mean, I would think that, you know, there's 250 players or so that are picked here, and I wonder how many of them make practice squad or maybe make the back end of
I guess I shouldn't say never play an NFL game, but never have, you know, I mean,
impact.
We don't know who's going to really have an impact, and we won't know for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say a majority of the guys drafted definitely appear in a game. It's just impactful type players. Everybody gets overly excited about a lot of guys, but I thought it was highly entertaining this year's draft. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it's you know, now they have three channels carrying it with the NFL Network, ESPN, and ABC now does it as well. So no, it's like everywhere you went, it was on TV and. I do kind of like it because you get different perspectives. So if you're not a complete football junkie and you don't want the X's and O's of it all, you can put on ABC, and it's more of, you know, kind of the background on the player, the human side of the athlete, rather than, you know, this guy runs a hell of an out route.
I was interested in I thought I saw this, and I don't have it in front of me, but at least on Thursday night, that the NFL draft had better ratings than the NBA playoffs.
Oh, no question.
And the NHL playoffs.
I mean, they had record ratings this weekend. There was over 500,000 people attending it in Nashville.
So this is a broadcast of who might be playing in September or maybe in 2 or 3 years, if you're a rookie or whatever it might be, as opposed to watching superstars play in meaningful games, sixes and sevens, in the NBA and NHL. That's pretty impressive.
The NFL remains king. Remember when there was all the turmoil in the NFL just like a year or two ago with the kneeling and all sorts of different things and the war with the president? And last year's season was just awesome. And much of it has to do with the emergence of some young quarterbacks, the Patrick Mahomes. If the Bears are good, it makes the NFL more interesting. It does. And I don't think that's a local bias here. I just think it is. I mean, you have a charter franchise, you know, near the top of the league in the standings, they have interesting players on the team. It changes it a lot. And the Rams, the emergence of them as well. So it's all of a sudden the NFL is like, okay, that's right. They're just reminding everyone they're king over every other sports league.
I believe the Chicago Bears have, what, 8 primetime, if you count the 3 o'clock games, the national games on Sunday. I think they're at 8 or 8.5. We don't see a noon game.
Not a lot of noon games. They have the most amount of primetime games you can have, which I think is actually 5, but I think it's 6 because you factor in the Thanksgiving game, plus they have the London game as well. So, you know, they're at high demand right now.
They are. Well, let's talk about the Chicago Bears. This was a draft that was kind of sold to be a draft for depth because the Chicago Bears, of course, tops of the NFC North. They're pretty young as it is. They're skilled at several positions. They don't necessarily need a lot of rookie help. But surprising that that didn't stop Ryan Pace from trading up to get this kid out of Iowa State. What do we know about this? And do you see this as a good move, Kevin?
Yeah, I like it a lot. Look, he doesn't have major burst speed. He ran a 4.640. If you watch his film, though, Bears fans are going to absolutely love this guy. He's tough to bring down. He's elusive, low center of gravity type guy. He's a tough running back. Played at Iowa State for 3 years. And, you know, I think, you know, they were a lot of people are talking about David Montgomery. Mike Davis is the guy they signed, the running back from Seattle. Then Tariq Cohen being your 3 running backs. I think you're probably going to see the more traditional type running back play calls for Montgomery and Mike Davis. And that opens up a lot more options for Tariq Cohen and what Matt Nagy can do with that. So I love the David Montgomery pick. They love him off the field. He's appears to be a great guy. Matt Nagy seems to be in love with him. So I think Bears fans are going to fall in love with David Montgomery.
So 708 points out the same thing that the next question I had is that, you know, the Bears got rid of Jordan Howard for a pretty low draft pick, I think for next year. But they got rid of him and then they drafted a kid. It wasn't really a money situation because Jordan Howard was yet to get paid. I mean, he's obviously getting close to the end of his deal. But what was it? Why get rid of Jordan Howard to draft a running back?
Well, I think it was pretty clear that Jordan Howard really didn't fit into Matt Nagy's offense. I mean, he was never great out of the backfield at catching the ball. And honestly, last year, Jordan Howard was sort of underwhelming, if you ask me. He didn't look all that impressive, didn't have a ton of breakaway speed as well. But I think Matt Nagy just wanted a guy that sort of he could handpick and fit into his system a little bit better. And I just don't think Jordan Howard ever really worked in that offense.
Yeah. Okay, let's continuing on that thread. There is something to be said that the Chicago Bears chose two skilled offensive players in the first two picks they had.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really think about last year, the defense was extremely dominant in NFL history kind of ways. And there was talk, you know, there was some attrition from free agency. He lost Adrian Amos and picked up Ha-Ha Clinton Dix instead. But there was this thought that maybe, you know, you build a depth because it's a little bit thin in the secondary. But mm-hmm. it really was about this underachieving offense that we want to see explode in Chicago, and they added some pieces.
Yeah, I think the more weapons, the better for Matt Nagy and obviously for Mitch Trubisky. They get Riley Ridley in the fourth round, and just about every scout, just about every draft analyst is giving that an A pick because this is a guy many had pegged as a second or third rounder. He didn't have a great NFL combine. I think that's one of the reasons he slipped down to the fourth round. But basically everything you've read about this guy says this was a steal of a draft for a draft pick for Ryan Pace and Matt Nagy and the Bears. So Riley Ridley out of Georgia, I love this pick.
And he was highlighted. I mean, he was showcased during the playoffs, the college playoffs.
Yeah,
he was if not the number one target for the Georgia Bulldogs up there.
Yeah, brother of Calvin Ridley, who plays in the NFL as well. So look, when most of the guys are projecting him as a second or third round draft pick, and you get him at four, that's a steal. Yeah. And I think that we saw the emergence. I shouldn't say necessarily the emergence, but it took some time, I think, for Mitch Trubisky to build some chemistry with his receivers. Some of that was because of Mitch Trubisky's play at times, but it's going to take time to have that trust and the confidence in your receivers. But, you know, Allen Robinson was the big free agent signing they had going into the year. Keep in mind, he was coming off an ACL injury, but down the stretch towards the last, I'd say, month of the season, you could tell Mitch Trubisky and Allen Robinson had kind of been clicking, and especially in that playoff game. You remember that throw Mitch had to Allen Robinson after the Tariq Cohen kickoff return that helped get them into field goal range.
Won that game that Cody Parkey lost.
Right? Exactly. That was a moment you're like, wow, that's, you know, those are those situations where you see the Rodgers and the Bradys and the top quarterbacks where they get the ball back with 50 seconds and a timeout and they need a field goal. And it always seems like they find a way to get their team down the field into field goal range. And in past years, that would have felt like impossible for any Bears quarterback to get the team back in field goal range. So for Trubisky to have the poise to get the team downfield and make a huge throw to Allen Robinson, which was between a cornerback and a safety in a tiny window and a huge moment in a playoff game, I think for a lot of people, that was sort of an eye-opening moment. I think a lot of people forget about it because all we keep remembering is the double doink and the heartbreak that followed that. But, you know, don't sleep on Allen Robinson this upcoming year.
Okay, so the offense will hopefully be better with these two additions. The defense, they went for the backfield, or for the defensive backfield.
Mm-hmm.
Two corners that were drafted in the sixth and seventh round. Are these guys worth anything?
I think Duke Shelley is the guy they think could be more of a slot guy, which they're going to need help with. They lost Bryce Callahan to free agency, so. Plus, some of these guys are aging. I mean, Prince Mukamara is 30, I think, now. He's going to be 31 by the season's time the season starts. So you wanted to add depth there. They did draft a guy from Valdosta State.
Yeah,
saying it right. A traditional powerhouse football school, Justin, as you know, Valdosta State. Steven Denmark, he's a seventh rounder. Look, if you can get anybody in the sixth or seventh round to contribute in any way, it's fine. I mean, to have any more expectations than maybe even a special teamer at that point is, I think wishful thinking.
And this kid's a project. I actually was reading it earlier. He's 6'4".
Big guy.
And he runs like the wind. He's running like a 4.4. And he was a former receiver, I think. He only made the transition maybe a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this thought that there was a lot of people in the NFL scouting ranks that were like, this guy could be huge. I mean, he's a huge project because they don't know. I don't know if he knows how to play the position, but overall, in terms of his athleticism, he's a freak.
Yeah, I think if you're going to draft a project, quote project, you probably should do it in the sixth or seventh round where, you know, maybe high risk, probably low risk, high reward if you do get a guy that's, you know, has a ton of talent and you can shape into the type of player you want. So if you are going to draft a project, fine with doing it that late in the draft.
There you go. That's a comprehensive look.
It was a fun draft, though. It was. Yeah. Despite the Bears not having a pick in the first and second rounds, there was the most trades ever. There's 40 trades over the 3 days, which was eclipsed last year, which was 38, I want to say. So It was just, it was fun to watch. I thought Nashville was a great host city as well.
Yeah.
Enough maybe for all the bachelorette parties that were ruined. Did you see that story, Justin?
No, they had a ton of
because, you know, Nashville's like the go-to spot now for bachelor parties and bachelorette parties. There was a news report of all these ticked off bachelorettes because they went to Nashville and they didn't know the draft was there. And it was completely packed everywhere they went.
Everywhere they went.
They weren't happy.
Yeah, that's never good. It's already packed as it is in Nashville. You had the NFL draft.
I mean, how do you not know the draft is going to be there?
Though? Yeah.
A little bit of research.
Yeah, a little bit. Right?
I mean, before you're going, you simply type in Nashville into Google like a week before. The first thing that's probably going to pop up is Nashville prepping for the draft.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they pick locations years out, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Years?
Yes.
Not months,
like a full year in advance, yeah. I hope they had a good time.
I would think that that would add to the excitement. You'd have a lot more people. If you're going for a bachelor,
that's what I was thinking.
I guess there's only a finite amount. Even in Nashville, there's a finite amount of bars. So I assume that it was packed to get into all the have to go tos. So
looked like a good time.
Yeah, good to talk to Kevin. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up John Williams' show, and then we will get over to Roe and Company to take us through the afternoon here on 720 WGN. John Williams Show. I'm Justin Kaufman in for John. John is in London today. And he's in Scotland as well on this trip. It's a Steve Bertrand travel trip. Yeah! Very exciting. We'll see. I'm sure he'll have much to talk about when he returns. Is he out for a week, Elif?
Yeah, he'll be back on Monday.
That's awesome. I know. I wish I could go to... Is he going to Edinburgh?
Yes. Yes, he is.
You know, I've been there a couple times. I went there when I was young and full of life. And I went there and did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival twice. And I loved that town.
What is that?
See, it's probably the biggest fringe theater festival in the world. It's on. It takes over Edinburgh in August. It pretty much triples the population. Every storefront there, every restaurant, everything turns into a theater space. And they do these all these little theater companies. There's some big ones too, but some little theater companies from all over the world come in, and it is just a great place to be if you're an artist, because not only do you get to perform in this amazing festival, but you get to fraternize with people from all over the world.
That's interesting.
It's so fun.
Never heard of that before, but seems like it would be a really good way to stay busy there.
It's a tremendous, it is a world-class festival. And I went in, speaking of the 90s, I went in 1998 and 2000. Those are my 2 years that I went. So it's been a long time since I've been there. So, but this is probably the best time to go to Edinburgh if you're a tourist, because of the fact that you have this great opportunity to go when it's not triple the population, right? So... 331 says, Justin, maybe the school could take an end-of-year photo of the entire student body, blow it up to the same size as the painting, and hang both in the cafeteria, showing how much we've progressed while retaining our past. It's, of course, about the Oak Park mural story that we did earlier in the show. That'd be a good way to do it. And I think that that's what Mark was talking about, just this concept that perhaps we can keep the past and almost add on to the future, meaning keep that mural or that painting as is and create a ancillary or additional painting that you could put up, maybe in the same cafeteria. Could be a good way to do that. Everybody wins in that case. It could be good. 312-981-7200. Let me do a quick talk about the news click. We have Friday's results. These are always weird because this one was about snow. So this was a thing about the snow. I hope you had a good weekend with that. I actually had to drive. This is a very small story where I had to go out to Indiana. It was my mother-in-law's birthday. And so we were going out there on Saturday morning and I saw the snow was coming in. So we actually got up early. We were going to beat the snow to Valpo. We're going to beat it. I'm going to use the data that I have to recognize when the actual storm is coming in. Da, 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 da. And I got to the gas station to get a quick a quick amount of gas to then I get the gas in Indiana to come back. And my tire was flat. A flat tire.
Oh.
Right? You're just like, oh, I can't get on the expressway.
Bad timing. Like, oh.
So I went over to Cassidy Tires, which is on Grand and Canal. It's a famous place. They've got awesome portraits of them from way back in the middle of the 20th century to the Chicago flood and all this kind of stuff. And they did a great job. I got out of there. It was just a nail. But I was watching the snow start. Like, I'm sitting there, like, all anxious, and I was nervous because I'm like, oh, my plan. I got to get on the road. And you could see the rain kind of turn to snow, and I'm like,
You know the saying, make a plan
right.
if you want to hear God laugh. Do you know that saying?
No, that's a good saying, though. It made sense.
I know, right?
He was laughing at me in the lobby of the Cassidy Tires.
Man, that's a bummer.
But I made it out. I made it out. I got out. It wasn't so bad because the pattern wasn't going towards Indiana yet, so it was just kind of like rain, so I just do it in rain. And then we stayed over because it hit Indiana later, and then we came back Sunday morning.
But, well, that's good.
Yeah, right, a little bit extra time.
Yeah, you didn't suffer as much as we did here, I guess.
No, so I missed the entire thing. They didn't really, it was just like kind of sleety in Indiana. They only got like maybe an inch of snow. I know that it was terrible up in the McHenry County, northern Wisconsin or northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin area. My parents live in that area, and they were supposedly got about 8 inches of snow.
Oof.
Yeah. So anyway, the news click says that the winner was the tomorrow, April 27th, got some snow again. Great. I love snow. Not great. See, I can't stand the sight of snow after a certain point. Will spring ever come? That was the winner overwhelmingly.
That was me, and I wrote that question. So I was so full of hate when I wrote this news click poll. I knew exactly what my favorite answer was going to be, and it was that one. And it won.
Yeah, good. You projected. You put a lot of energy into that. You're like, you put a lot of good vibes out into the internet.
Like, I like it, Elif. It makes sense. No matter how much you love snow, there are times it's just not warranted. Shouldn't be here.
Yeah, like, I like snow in the winter.
Yeah.
I think it looks beautiful, even on the weekends, because I didn't have a plan to go outside anyway. But when you have a day like Friday where it's beautiful out,
I know, right?
You expect that the whole weekend is going to be like that. I don't know why. It's a psychological thing.
But then psychological.
You look at your weather app and you're just in complete disbelief.
I have to say that my brother's moving back. He was in California, moving back to Chicago. He came back Saturday. And I was so annoyed. It was more personal to me because, I want my brother to stay. I want him to like Chicago. I want him to, you come from California, you really got to think about the weather. And on Friday when I was talking to him, it was 60 degrees. I'm like, it's perfect here.
Yep.
And he flew in and his flight was delayed by 5-6 hours to fly into the snow of Chicago. And I was like, it's a one-timer. It's a one-timer.
So. That's a lie, though.
Well, for now.
Such a lie.
For the next 5 months, it should be good.
I don't know. Right now, we're at an every 2 week basis, right?
And of course, this week is going to be all rain.
Don't set that precedent, please.
See, but now I'm just, if it's nice out, I'll be like, well, see, Lauren, you were wrong.
Yeah,
we should all be happy.
All right. That's going to do it for the John Williams Show. I'm Justin Kaufman. Real quick, the next TJ Show, May 18th, Classic Cinemas, Tivoli Theater, 10 a.m. This is the Thomas Jefferson Show. Mm-hmm. You can get your tickets online.
Thomas Jefferson's going to be here today.
Yeah, he is?
Mm-hmm. At 4:50 p.m.
Oh, then there you go. That works out. Perfect.
I would just want to ask him about how does one brush wooden teeth? Did he have wooden teeth? I just want to know the answer to that question. I got one question.
Maybe you could use a quip.
We only get 2 minutes with him, and I just, because he's dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 2 minutes I won't have with a couple members of the Game of Thrones cast before it's all said and done.
Yeah, I'm going to miss some of them.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them went down.
Wooden teeth was Washington, but you know what?
Whatever.
It's your show.
I think that's the case. I don't know. I don't have a dental chart of any of the founding fathers. But if I did, I would like to know. And, and obviously now Jefferson, he got around, Right?
Well, he did.
Yeah.
France, he was back home.
No. He got around.
Oh, got around.
He got around, around.
Ah.
He had a lot going on.
Right.
He had, there was Molly Jefferson or whatever her name was. And then there was the woman that was a slave that he had the children with, right?
Yep.
He had some courtesans in France, as they would say back then. And I just think, you know, I want to know. These are the things I want to know about Thomas Jefferson. I'm not exactly 100% sure that I'm going to get all the answers, but I'm going to go for it.
So that's the you got one with the wooden teeth, two with the he gets around. Got it. That's the, you're giving us your prep.
There's no time for anything else. Right, thanks for asking.
Mm-hmm. What's on the show today?
That's it. Oh, well, A.B. Stoddard is going to be here. Also, Ben Bradley is going to get us very interesting stuff that's going on down in Springfield. You know, they got 2 days left to get the gambling, to get me gambling and pot before they can't get it. And we need gambling and pot, like, right now.
They have to introduce it.
We certainly need the tax money.
Yeah, we could use the tax money. We could use a lot of things. So that's that. I mean, I hate to be, you know, so simple about this. I don't really, the pot doesn't do anything for me.
No?
No. The other one, on the other hand, would make the NFL season a lot more interesting. Demetrius Ivory is going to join us to talk about how we just missed a record, but more importantly, what is this week going to be like?
Yeah, it's going to be something.
Yeah.
It's a little taste of what's to come.
So we got all that coming.
All right, we'll be listening.
Well, thank you very much, Justin.
Bye, Justin.
It's great working with you again.